This is Marilyn Gleason. It's time for Valley Voices. We bring interviews to you twice a month. And today I'm going to be talking to Brett AD from AD Honey Farms. He's a fourth generation beekeeper. He has somewhere between 40,000 and 100,000 beehives at any given time. One of the largest commercial beekeeping operations in America. I spoke to Brett AD just a couple of days ago in Reno, Nevada. We were both there for the American Beekeeping Federation annual conference. So stay tuned for Brett AD and me from Reno, Nevada.
Well, we have more commonality than we have differences. So, yeah. We all breathe the same air. We all drink the same water. Yeah.
I'm talking to Brett AD, and you're a large-scale commercial beekeeper.
Good morning, Marilyn. We're at the American Beekeeping Federation Bee Conference in Reno, Nevada, and we've had a really informative time here, and we've got a visit with some of our friend beekeepers from, you know, the years, and sometimes we're always too busy to make time to visit during the year, but it's been really nice to renew some old acquaintances and make new acquaintances and listen to the top scientists we have in the industry and some of the top ecological scientists that are involved in using bees as one of their study metrics. So anyway, it's been a really good conference here, Marilyn.
Tell me a little bit about the location and the size of your operation.
Oh, we run a multi-state beekeeping operation, and we go for manage our bees for honey and pollination. And so we like to start our year where we make the new bees, and our year starts in March in Mississippi and Louisiana and Texas, where we breed and new bees and raise queen cells to make new queens for the beehives. And as we progress into mid-May, we move our honeybees up to the upper Midwest. So we experience a second spring because spring buildups are phenomenal for the health of the bees. And we move primarily most of the bees into central South Dakota, with some going over into Minnesota and some going into North Dakota. And we'll manage them there for the summer. And in the fall, we'll take them out to California and manage them on the desert until the almonds are ready to bloom. And then we pollinate the almonds and do a little bit of secondary pollination on with a smaller number of bees. And then we'll move all the rest of the bees back to the breeding operation on the Gulf Coast again. So we make a big triangle across the western half of the United States with our bees.
And how many hives are we talking about?
Oh, very many. This year we brought out 100 semi-loads of bees to the West Coast, and that's a diminished number. 10 years ago, I was bringing over 150 semi-loads of bees, and the biggest challenge to keeping the numbers where we want is, you know, landscape uses and agrochemicals, and some of the agrochemicals have very adversely affected the bees. They were probably licensed for the right reason, but with not enough research. And so one of the chief ones that causes a lot of angst to bees is the neonicotinoid class of insecticides.
And these are fairly new. And as your bees are moving around through all these agricultural areas, they are getting exposure to all the various pesticides in use.
Yeah, and different areas are different exposures. But this class of chemical, it works different than what we've been, you know, beekeepers have always had concerns with insecticides because insecticides kill our livestock. And, you know, in the 70s we had insecticides that were hard on bees, and in the 80s we had it. And so we've always had challenges with keeping bees healthy because of agrochemicals. But this other challenge, the neonic, became a different class. It's a systemic class, and so it becomes part of the plant. And so anyway, when it becomes part of the plant, it's different than something that's on top of the plant that will dissipate in a few days. So anyway, this dissipates over time, and it was originally, I think, initiated primarily as a human health concern, and the EPA people didn't do enough due diligence, in my opinion, on looking at the adverse effects on beneficial insects. They were primarily, as they probably should, looking at human health effects and trying to get some hotter chemistries that are harder on people off the market, but they never did the adequate research to look at what it does to beneficials. And that's where we're at right now. And this product, you know, was released, I think, in the early 2000s, and bees started dying in about 2005. And my bees took a big hit in 2008.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about just your path, because there was a time when you just thought these bees were dying because of bad beekeeping practices.
That's correct, and it's a little embarrassing, my original ignorant statements. But anyway, I thought we just had bad beekeeping practices and that a virus was going through our population and a virus would go through and then disappear. My bees got beat up by that quote-unquote virus, and we got them rebuilt, and then we've had them beat up again and again and again, and I believe it was 2009, I was asked to be on a industry panel or board called the National Honeybee Task Force. And we started looking at what's happening with bees, and we went to the EPA, and we started getting involved with the EPA Pesticide Program Dialogue Committee and studied more and more. And science started coming out really hard on the neonics, and what I started as a issue for financial reasons, I got in there to protect my financial interest in honeybees, and as I studied more, I realized this is way bigger than a financial interest. What's happening in the environment and being reflected by the honeybees, I consider a moral initiative now, because what's happening now, I think, you know, we've got to take charge of this situation because it's going to affect our children and our grandchildren, and we have just a responsibility as beekeepers, you know, almost being that first line of defense, because our organisms that we manage have such short lifespans, and they're showing up in that lifespan, and this new class of insecticide is a neurotoxin, basically. And anyway...
Can you talk to me about some of the health effects that you're concerned about and what you see in the bees, and, you know, be a little more specific about the deleterious effects of these neonics?
Well, I'll primarily stick to the papers that I've read. And one of the first things that I come across was, you know, we know the lethality of the neonic class, and which is really interesting. It's changed continually. We started out, I think, around... 200 parts per billion, then it dropped down to 50 parts per billion, and then it dropped down to 20, then 10, then 5. So the, you know, level of concern for bees being exposed to this product is just continually getting more sensitive. And
is that because of increased sensitivity, or is that just more studies showing that it takes less to have the bad effects?
I believe it's all because of more studies became public, and we had more scientists looking at it that weren't industry scientists. University scientists around the world started looking at this. And one of the things that first came to my attention, besides the lethality of it with direct exposure, was the chronic effects, you know, chronic effects showing the bees were losing their immune function, and that was done by some studies over in Europe, and DiPrisio was the man, and he showed that decreased immune function when bees were exposed to sublethal, or we should say maybe slow lethality amounts, and some of his other work showed that, you know, increased mite production, the mites, because the bees lost maybe grooming function because it's a neurotoxin. They mites increase faster on bees that have been exposed to this.
And these are the main parasites for bees?
The mites are a parasite, and mites probably aren't near as damning as they're made out to be. We're managing mites, but the real problem is these decreased immune function in our bees, because the mites vector natural viruses. Natural viruses that have been here since God made the planet that didn't used to be, you know, lethal. They were just background viruses, and they may affect the performance of a honeybee for a little while, and then the hive as an organism would recover, and now we have organisms that aren't recovering.
So we are seeing, like, increased losses.
Being in bees my entire life and remembering when we had winter losses of 5%, I thought was completely unacceptable. Now USDA says an acceptable loss is somewhere around 22%. And
it was twice that last year.
Oh, yeah, and our national losses are running close to 50%. And so anyway, and that's just the recorded ones, and that's after beekeepers put a lot of effort into requeening during the summer. You know, back in the day, we never requeened in the summer. We made nukes in the spring, and those nuclei hives, you know, performed all the way till the next spring, and we had so many bees we didn't know what to do with them. Now, you know, if we can get a 50% survival, we're running at the national average.
So, and you're really tracing this to the poisons, basically, that the bees are being exposed to in the environment.
Well, that's a big, big contributing factor to it. And anyway, and then landscape use changes, too. There's not the food out there that there used to be for bees. And so,
talk to me about that.
Well, you know, as with the rollout of herbicides, you know, herbicides were in their infancy in the 70s and the 80s, and then glyphosate came along in the mid 90s and changed the landscape, because back in the day, we'll use that phrase, and I hope I don't use it too much, you know, in the 1980s, there wasn't a soybean field that wasn't loaded with milkweed, and you'd see butterflies out there foraging on them. You'd see the honeybees foraging on them, and there was a secondary nectar and pollen source across a lot of the landscape. And then we've got the, you know, very intense agrochemical herbicides that made that a sterile environment almost, and so that challenges the bee, you know.
So the glyphosate kills all the other plant life?
Yeah, it's, you know, a very hot herbicide, and the only plants that live through it are either highly selected or genetically modified.
In some places, and at some times, there's been sort of a division between some of the commercial beekeepers who are working really closely with agriculture and the more small scale or the general public who is maybe, you know, more concerned with just the, you know, loving, saving the honeybees and that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a red herring. I don't think there's any really actuality to it at all. I think we all want a clean, healthy environment for our bees so they have that natural survival pattern. And we also, extremely more importantly, we want a clean, healthy environment for our children and our grandchildren. And so I think this is just one of those, oh, issues that's brought up to cause divisiveness so we can't make progress.
You're listening to Valley Voices on KDNK, our twice monthly interview program hosted by me, Marilyn Gleason. And today I'm talking to Brett Ady of Ady Honey Farms. Brett Ady is one of the largest commercial beekeeping operators in America. He has tens of thousands of colonies of bees. And in the next part of the interview, we're going to be talking about some of his experiences and challenges with the Environmental Protection Agency, and specifically working on regulation of some of these neonicotinoid pesticides. Stay tuned. The EPA, which is, you know, the government arm that's really responsible for protecting that environment, sometimes gets caught up more in the economics and politics. I mean, the environment is one of their concerns, but they also have a lot of pressures from economic interests in the country as well.
That's a good statement, and an accurate statement, and unfortunate reality too, because I think some of the arguments that are presented to them by industry aren't on point. They have the industry's weighted view, and the industry's, when I say industry, are large chemical and agrochemical companies, and they have their weighted view in them, and the rest of us don't have quite the time or resources to make our different views made and show them the science that we found. And a lot of their policies are based not only on science, which would be the idyllic world, but on economics. And what we've realized in our experience as beekeepers, going back and forth and visiting with the EPA and being on various committees and also being, you know, in different hearings, is that the priorities and decisions aren't always made on science. A lot of the decisions are made based on economics, and our opinion is the economic models are very incomplete because they're not realizing the financial contributions of beneficial insects, honeybees and other pollinators and predators. A lot of their modeling is the crop, the bad bug, and what it costs to kill the bad bug. An incomplete model. And the real model should be the crop, the bad bug, and the good bugs. Will the good bugs eat the bad bugs? Will the good bugs provide more pollination and a higher yield that negates what the bad bug was doing? I think their modeling is very incomplete, and we want to address this as beekeepers because we do not believe that they're valuing beneficials and ourselves, primarily honeybees, but all beneficials near enough, because, you know, any good home gardener knows about ladybugs. They know about lacewings, and there's a lot of good bugs that will do the work, so we don't have to use the bad chemicals. Occasionally there may be a blow up, but I don't think their models are correct, and we want to challenge that.
It's sort of the difference between a short term and a long term view of those economic benefits and costs. I was very interested that it sounded like some of the more senior people in the EPA actually have an economics background rather than that scientific background, which tends to be more mid-level.
I couldn't make a current comment, but when I was going there continually about 4 or 5 years ago, I was shocked that some of the highest level people had their doctorates in economics instead of microbiology or toxicology or chemistry. It just absolutely shocked me.
In agriculture, you have the people who are growing the crops and worrying about the bugs, but then you've also got beekeepers, which is sort of a little different area of agriculture. Another way to look at it is that the beekeeping industry brings a different economic perspective to agriculture and kind of represents a different point of view. And actually, like, it's an economic interest that's maybe a little different than most of the people in agriculture.
Yeah, I think it's a big extension problem because, you know, if you start researching this enough, you know, bees are known to give that big benefit to apples. Bees are known to give that big benefit to cherries. And, you know, obviously bees give a big benefit to almonds. But in what we call our auto-pollinated crops, the ones that we don't think we need bees on the landscape, there is beautiful benefits to having bees in the landscape. There was recently a metadata study done in Iowa that showed having bees on the landscape next to soybean fields was a 20% yield bump. And there was work done in Minnesota back, 3 or 4 decades ago, showing a big yield gain on sunflowers. And then that was duplicated again at one of the ARS research institutions here only about 10 years ago, showing there's still a big gain in sunflowers by having bees on that landscape. And, you know, we go crop after crop that, you know, I've seen some cotton research that you get heavier lint yield and a better set by having bees on the landscape. And so bees on the landscape are, you know, one of those things that's been discounted on a lot of our auto-pollinated crops. Our cross-pollinated crops, it's very well documented, but it's not well documented. So I think we can have a win-win situation for the beekeepers, the American farmers, and the American consumers if we have better understanding of the, you know, how all everything works together.
Mm-hmm. And beekeepers kind of bring that, you know, the bees could be kind of an indicator species for sort of the big picture of what agriculture is doing.
Yeah, bees are definitely an indicator species because of the short lifespan, and primarily there's a lot of good indicator species, but they're not managed commercially. And so, you know, you may have somebody that looks at dung beetles or butterflies or any other unique lacewings, ladybugs, you know, it goes on and on. These can all be good indicator species, but it takes a, you know, a paid person out there and studying it and trying to record data, and it's only a limited set where we have beekeepers across the whole nation looking at beehives daily. And so the feedback mechanism is so much more intense with honeybees than any other insect we have in our system. And so that's where bees and beekeepers become the, you know, really a good indicator of what's going on.
Yeah, sort of the voice of the insects. Can you tell me a little bit about the Pollinator Stewardship Council?
The Pollinator Stewardship Council is a group that was formed from the two national trade associations, the American Beekeeping Federation and the American Honey Producers, originally started out with the National Honey Bee Advisory Board. And this advisory board started industry talks. And some of the very first talks were with the agrochemical companies, and then after that with the EPA. And we decided we need to take it up the next level. And so in time, we evolved to the Stewardship Council, trying to reach out to a bigger group of people than just the commercial beekeepers, because originally started out as just all commercial beekeepers and that focus. And now we realize that, you know, it's everybody that needs to be involved in this.
What's the work to be done right now, and how can people get involved?
Well, the Pollinator Stewardship Council is working on trying to build a better database of what actual damages are. We had field hearings back, I think it was in 2014, where top EPA administrators told us bee guys are losing about $300 million worth of bees and bee products a year. And as things go, somewhere in the course of our trips back to Washington, we're told that, hey, to make the EPA do the right thing, you'll probably have to sue us. And all of a sudden, a light came on. It's like, oh, this is a takings idea. So anyway, takings goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. And when the King of England would fight the King of France, or they would go back and forth, he would take the livestock to feed the army. And the people on the east side of the country got tired of supporting the army, while the people on the west didn't have to support it. So they came up with this idea: we don't mind taking care of the country and the army, but you need to pay us for our livestock. And so anyway, this is kind of the original idea of the bees. It's like, well, if we're going to do this, you need to pay us for our livestock that you're doing. If these chemicals are for the good of the country and we have to absolutely have it to feed the country, then you need to make us whole. And that was the original idea. And like I said, as we studied this more and looked at it from a bigger picture and further back from just our beekeeper picture, it's like, no, this is bigger than just takings. But this is where I think we want to go, is build a big database to show that we have a takings issue here, bring it to the EPA in a type of a lawsuit, and from there maybe get some compensation, but ideally change the policies so beneficial insects are valued in their analysis and their modeling, so the products aren't used so prophylactically. There have been instances across the, you know, where the European Union has banned the use of neonics on highly attractive plants to honeybees, and we've seen what looks like they're anecdotal right now, but I think we're going to have good data and it will become hard science. But bee survival numbers are going up in the EU the last couple of winters, and in the Ontario province they've restricted the use to where the farmers can still use the product if they have parasites in their soil, but if they don't have parasites that are verified by their county agents, then they don't use the product. And I think this is the ideal win-win situation. The farmers still have the chemistry if they absolutely need it, but there's not a lot of environmental loading just for sales. And so we've starting to see, and like I said, right now it's anecdotal, but the bee survival numbers are going up over there in the wintertime now. And so I think we're starting to get a healthier environment there now too. And so I think that's the goal we all want, is to have the farming community have it if they absolutely have to have it, but not have it used prophylactically and just to improve sales for a chemical manufacturer.
And $300 million, the impact on the beekeepers and the bee industry sounds like a big number, but it's really just a sliver when you start comparing it to the numbers of agriculture in the country, and that's sort of what you're up against.
Yeah, well, that is a big number, and that's an old number, but you have to remember the input of honeybees to our food supply is somewhere between $18 and $30 billion, depending on whose numbers you use. And so anyway, and that's at the farm gate before the food is processed. And so the processed food value to our food supply is huge. And so the direct loss to beekeepers, you know, people sometimes like look at beekeeping and, you know, it's a bit of a cottage industry. And it's like when you look at the total dollars of all American agriculture and our food system, you know, we're a rounding error, but it's just like an engine in a car or a truck or an airplane. We're the lubricating oil. You know, you might need $8 of lubricating oil in your car engine, but if you don't have that, all of a sudden a $5,000 engine is destroyed. And you get to your trucks or your airplanes, it's $20 worth of lubricating oil and a $10,000 engine. So anyway, you know, we may not be a big economic number, but we're a critical component.
So are you suing the EPA?
We got to build the data sets first, and if the data sets show that we have a case, we'll be doing it. We'd like everybody to, you know, is interested in their food supply and honeybees, their children and grandchildren, to get involved with the Pollinator Stewardship Council. We'll need names that show for membership, to show that we are actually a organization that you should listen to. And we also need dollar bills to do our data set collections. And we're working on hiring an economist right now.
Anything else you want to add today, Brett?
No, I would just thank you for your time and your concern. And anyway, we very much appreciate your support, both in any amount, you know, if it's only, you know, that Starbucks coffee a month or whatever.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
I spoke to Brett Ady in Reno, Nevada at the American Beekeeping Federation a couple of days ago. They just had their big conference there. Brett Ady is a fourth-generation beekeeper with Ady Honey Farms. He manages about 100 semi-loads of bees, and we were very happy to have him here today. Stay tuned to KWFO.